Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Denise Shader-Smith, mother of the late Mallory Smith, author of Salt in My Soul. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shin Shin Yot, Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benicot. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. After a week of unleavened food that ended either Friday night or Saturday night, depending on whether you are Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox and living in Israel or outside of it, Passover's now absolutely over. As I returned my home kitchen to its year-round chametz status, I discovered, as I do every year, that I had boxes of uneaten matzah. You know, you buy the 5 pounds of boxes of matzah because it's a better deal. You need a couple of boxes for the Seder by itself, and then you end up with one or two boxes left at the end of Passover, just when you really don't want to see matzah again for a very, very long time. So, what to do? How do you use up all those boxes of the unleavened bread of intestinal affliction? I have often suggested that if we burn chametz just before we begin Passover, we should therefore burn leftover matzah after Passover. But this idea has never quite caught on. Instead, to play us in this morning, in her now classic song, past two Jewish guest Michelle Citron tells you 20 things you can do with matzah after Passover is over.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzo pick and play the guitar, and you can make a matzo license plate for your car. Use it as a coaster when you're drinking your beer, or you can throw it as confetti for a happy new year.
7. Insulate.
8. Decorate.
9. Exfoliate.
10.
Constipate?
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Crumble up some matzah to line your hamster cage, or you can use it as a bookmark to hold your page. Break a stack of matzo when you practice your karate. Build a matzo doghouse for your doggy named Scotty. Make a little matzo board and wave it goodbye. Or you can make a pair of matzo wings and learn how to fly. Wear some matzo jewelry. Make a picture frame for me. Have a drink of matzo tea. Matzah's all that I can see. There's just one more thing to do with unleavened bread. You can eat it, 'cause it ain't all that bad.
That was Michelle Citron's 20 things to do with matzah after Passover's over. If you have other ways, let me know. You can email me at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail. You know, I've got to figure it all out before I find myself again looking at 2 or 3 leftover boxes when cleaning for Passover next year. So, Passover's over, which means we are now in the period of the counting of the Omer, the time between Passover, the Festival of Freedom, and Shavuot, Holiday of Covenant and Torah. For the 7 weeks between Pesach and Shavuos, we take a few moments each evening to say a blessing and count the days that lead us towards a reaffirmation of our brit, our covenant with God, as certified at Mount Sinai. As the passage in Proverbs says, teach us to count our days so that we can make every day count. The counting of the Omer reminds us we have the capacity to make every single day matter and to bring holiness into our lives every day. In the Sfirat HaOmer, the prayer we chant each night, there is a famous passage, Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, may the temple be rebuilt speedily in our day. It's a classic liturgical text, but more than that, it's a metaphor for what we wish in our own lives at this time of year. May we continually seek to rebuild ourselves. If we can do that, perhaps we can really rebuild our world, which needs it. Here's the climax of Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, as sung by cantor Moshe Stern with the IDF Orchestra and chorus.
Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash,
was Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, a classic concert piece composed by Shalom Secunda, as sung by cantor Moshe Stern, a true remarkable classic cantorial tenor. It's for the period of the counting of the Omer, the agriculturally oriented time of dedication we have now entered into on the Jewish calendar. Our guest this morning is Denise Shader Smith, mother of the late Mallory Smith, author of the moving memoir Salt in My Soul. Denise is an impressive guest, having turned loss into motivation and meaning that can help all of us. Meet her when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Diane Shader Smith, is the editor of her daughter's book, Salt in My Soul, An Unfinished Life, by Mallory Smith. Her daughter Mallory died at the age of 25 from cystic fibrosis, but that's not really the story. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
So your daughter was diagnosed at the age of 3 with CF. It's a death sentence. It's just a question of when. I do know someone who's lived well into their 40s, but that is an anomaly. Tell us a little bit about, as a mom, that process, and then tell us about your daughter from her beginnings.
Well, it was devastating to receive the news, but they have a lot of treatments, and they did tell us early on that we would dance at her wedding, and so that's one of the great tragedies, that she died 2 months after receiving a double lung transplant. But in general, she had a very happy childhood, and made the decision to live happy early on and had crammed so much of life into her 25 years. It's remarkable.
She was an extraordinary young woman, tall, athletic. She went to Stanford, and she had this incredible energy. It emerges in her prose. Did you realize she was keeping a journal?
I always knew that she was keeping a journal. She was always writing in it or typing in it because it was an electronic journal. And when she was younger, I used to try to break into it because I thought, oh my God, what's she writing about? But
That's such a mom thing to do. I'm sorry.
Well, I know I shouldn't really admit that, but I think it would be dishonest not to. But anyway, I never found it because she had it deeply embedded and password protected. So it wasn't until the end when she gave me her password that I actually read it, and it was after she passed away that I first opened it, because when I tried to sneak in, I didn't feel badly about getting in, but when she actually gave me the password, only in case she didn't make it, not because she wanted me to read it at that point, I felt that her trust in me sort of required me to do the right thing and not look, and I didn't.
When you discovered it, when you got in and saw the whole of it, did you think you were going to have it published as a book?
Well, she left me instructions to share the parts that she had written about that were too painful or emotional or embarrassing during her life. So she always thought that I would do something with it, and she left me very specific instructions for what to do. She wanted me to edit out the parts that would hurt her friend. She wanted to edit me to edit out details of her love life that she didn't want her father or her brother to see. And she wanted to make sure that nobody was hurt in the process, and that the stuff that wasn't really relevant to a mainstream audience, she didn't really want to share that part of her life. But she experienced so much in 67 hospitalizations that each one ranged from weeks to months. And she has a lot of insight. And that's actually on the book tour that I'm doing, which so far has 70 stops. I share those insights. And it's amazing to me how it's resonating with people across the country and in different types of arenas because of the fact that her writing is so relatable.
It is. We will talk much more with Diane Shader-Smith about her daughter, Mallory Smith. The book is called Salt in My Soul, An Unfinished Life. We'll return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in the foothills and northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located currently at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, just across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night at Skyline and Campbell for Tat Kabbalat Shabbat services for very young children and their parents at 5:30 p.m., followed by Shabbat services at 6:30 p.m. for everyone, with Saturday morning Torah study at 9 and Shabbat services in the morning at 10 a.m. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great Hebrew school and Torah Tikes program, and rich array of adult education academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, or go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about the Turkish elections, in which there was a big upset. Erdogan, the longtime, how shall we say this gently, leader of Turkey, His party was defeated in Ankara, defeated in Istanbul by a very narrow margin. And it's kind of a shock because Erdogan has seemed to have an iron fist of control over Turkey. He's been anti-Israel in many ways. What does all this mean?
Well, he's also been very much against freedom of the press. And there are actually more journalists jailed in Turkey than anywhere else in the world.
That's right, yeah.
So Erdogan is a model of the sort of strong man verging on dictatorship or with dictatorial tendencies, who's nationalistic, who's extremely conservative, that is haunting much of Europe today. I mean, this is a specter that is also in Western Europe. I mean, you know, although geographically Turkey is only partially European, as a country and a culture, it's largely European. And this is not a phenomenon, unfortunately, that's restricted to Turkey. We see it in many other countries.
Of course, and, Hungary. And,
you know, one can be very hopeful and say that, you know, maybe the end of Erdogan is a harbinger of better things and that other right-wing dictators will also fail at the elections if they allow elections to take place. This election in Turkey might cause them to think twice about that. But, you know, Turkey is a very important partner for the U.S. It's a NATO ally. It's a pillar of relative stability in the region. And it's a democracy. And by the vision of its founder, Ataturk, it's a secular democracy.
Now, Erdogan, of course, has played to his religious base extensively in the course of his career.
And multiplied many-fold the taxes on alcohol, which is also an interesting thing because Turkey's Muslims are like American Jews. There's 100 different varieties, and most of them are not religious or totally traditional. Many, many Muslims in Turkey drink at least beer or wine, if not also strong alcohol. And this is especially an indulgence that the poor used to be able to afford. A good domestically produced Turkish beer, an Efes Pilsen, for example, or a domestically produced Turkish rakı was something that everybody could have. Now, taxes went up like 10 times on these things. So suddenly, one of the comforts of the poor, who are Erdogan's electoral base, were taken away. And, you know, that's one of these things that can backfire. It was taken away in the name of Islam, but it's a version of Islam that not all that many Turks subscribe to. So for American interests, Israeli interests, etc., it was always good to have a democracy full of moderate Muslims in the region playing a leadership role. That position sort of wavered under Erdogan, and maybe now we have reason to hope that Turkey will return to play that role and return to its glory days.
And I might also add a close alliance with Israel, which was a big part of the Turkish model until Erdogan. Thanks so much, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Bernie, a very elderly Jewish man, is critically ill. Feeling that death is close, he calls his lawyer. I want to become a lawyer. How much is it for that express degree you told me about? It's $50,000, the lawyer says, but why? You'll be dead soon. Why do you want to become a lawyer now? That's my business, answers Bernie. Get me the course. 4 days later, Bernie gets his law degree. The lawyer is at the bedside, making sure the bill is paid. Suddenly, the old man is racked with fits of coughing, and it's clear this will be the end. Curious, the lawyer leans over and says, please, Bernie, before it's too late, tell me why you wanted to get a law degree so badly before you died. In a faint whisper, as he takes his very last breath, Bernie says, "Von less Jewish lawyer." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. My apologies to all my Jewish attorney friends. Please don't sue me. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benekot, representing the Wine Tribe Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So we just had Pesach. Now we have another different kind of holiday, Yom HaShoah, the Day of Remembrance for the Holocaust, which is observed in the United States and in Israel and for Jewish communities around the world. night of May 1st and May 2nd. May 2nd is the date. I, for the life of me, cannot remember how Yom HaShoah is observed in Israel. I lived there, but I don't recall it. Tell us a little bit about it.
So in my experience, I experienced it because I'm only 18, only as like a student in school. So from what I remember, we had in our moshav, in where I live, we had how will I call it? Like a ceremony.
Yeah, a tekes, okay. A ceremony.
Yeah, tekes. And then in our schools, we had a tekes as well in the morning, like in the actual day. It was a very you can feel it in the, you can feel the sad vibe in the air, I think, all around. Everyone is like, you can see their faces, you can see their, like, how they act. Everyone is like experiencing it together. In the evening and in the morning, you can see that everyone's in a certain vibe, all like everyone is on the same wave of like the remembrance of that day. The ceremonies are really touching. Sometimes they bring Holocaust survivors. It, every year it gets harder and harder, unfortunately.
Well, because obviously not as many are alive, of
yeah.
course.
Right? And it's just, you can really, I feel like, so, you can really feel
you
the...
You sense that memory of the Shoah. Yeah. I think the Holocaust is a much more obvious presence in Israel than in any other place. I mean, yes, of course, you go to Europe, you see the places where it happened, but for a vital... active Jewish community, it's very interesting how much that still hangs over the heads, hangs over your head a little bit in Israel. Talk about the siren a little bit. Maybe people have seen videos of the siren or been in Israel for the siren for Yom HaZikaron, Israel Remembrance Day, before Yom HaTzmaut, the Independence Day, but this is a little different.
So in Yom HaZikaron, we have two sirens, one at the evening of Yom HaZikaron and one at the day itself. And in Yom HaShoah, we only have one at the day itself. I think that it's really important to have those sirens. I mean, you just stop for 2 minutes and really think with yourself and feel it. And you can just see, it's amazing. You can see all, like as Rotem said, we experienced it at school, but you can see the whole school just stands and everyone are quiet, just respecting the ceremony and what we're doing now and who we're remembering. And it's really emotional. That's what I feel.
Really powerful.
Yeah.
Listen, remembrance is so central to Jewish life, or the people who remember. So an important day coming up and an important time to connect with those survivors who are still alive and also to remember those who are gone. Thank you so much. Toda rabah.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Achrei Mot near the midpoint of the book of Leviticus, Vayikra. Leviticus is centered on the question of how we create holiness in our lives, and Achrei Mot addresses that issue in a variety of ways. It begins with words that are poignant without being revealing. After the death of Aaron's two sons, it starts, referring to Nadav and Avihu, the two young priests who died in the Torah portion of Shmini for offering strange and perhaps inappropriate fire to the Lord. Aaron is enjoined to be cautious and scrupulous in all of his observances, lest he incur a similar punishment to that of his sons. Our portion then moves to the rituals related to the great and powerful Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, holiest day of the whole year for our ancestors, as it remains for us. We are commanded to afflict our souls on that day, Ta'anu et Nafshotechem. The rites described in Achrei Mot are quite detailed and form the basis for the ways in which our ancestors observed the Day of Atonement throughout the period when the temple stood in Jerusalem. The high priest purified himself completely, then offered sacrifices of atonement for himself, for his family, and for his people. He would then purify the holiest parts of the shrine of the temple and bring forward a goat as an atonement offering. That goat is one of the peculiarities of this ritual sequence. Actually, it's two goats that are brought out. One, the scapegoat. This portion is the origin of that term and that concept. The scapegoat is given the burden of symbolically carrying off the sins of the people into the wilderness. The second goat is sacrificed as an atonement offering on the altar. Ultimately, after a day of self-denial and repentance, Ki vayom hazeh yechaper alechem letaher etchem b'kol chatotechem. On that day, atonement shall be made for you to purify you from all your sins. Through this process, and I guess through the sacrifice of that goat, we are to be restored to holiness. Much of the rest of Achremot reflects the ways in which we fail to remain holy, however, and establishes rules to try to keep us on the straight and narrow. We are not to practice idolatry, nor engage in blood sport, nor eat carrion, and so on. Each prohibition is another way of structuring holiness into our lives, or keeping us from engaging in unholy behaviors. Finally, Achremot is interested in the question of establishing the prohibited degrees of marriage, the people with whom we are not permitted to enter into matrimony, laws of consanguinity and moral respect for those most closely related to us. In essence, the emphasis throughout Achremot is on the ways in which we reestablish a close relationship with God, and, perhaps having lost it, reacquire holiness. In a world in which our focus today is so far from holiness, so shaped by the daily details of our lives, the klaxon call of commercial society, the siren song of electronic distraction, this emphasis on the sacred in our portion is striking. In the words of the Psalms, "Keep yourself from evil, strive to do what is good, and seek holiness every day." Outstanding principles to live by today, too. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Denise Shader-Smith, will share what she learned from her extraordinary daughter, Mallory, who died from cystic fibrosis still in her 20s, and what her remarkable journals revealed. Find out when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
It has officially happened. Jewish comedian Volodymyr Zelensky won a landslide victory in Ukraine's presidential election, making the comic actor, with no experience in government or the military, commander-in-chief of a country that's been at war with Russian proxy armies for over 5 years. Zelensky won more than 73% of the vote, compared with just 25% for Petro Poroshenko, Ukraine's incumbent president. Zelensky triumphed in every region except for the area around the city of Lviv, a center of Ukrainian culture and nationalism in the West. Ukraine's Central Election Commission said the final official results might not be ready until April 30th because of the Orthodox Easter holiday that takes place today. Zelensky's victory will give Ukraine its first Jewish leader, delivering a stinging rebuke to the political and business establishment represented by Poroshenko, a billionaire candy tycoon who had campaigned on the nationalist slogan, Army, Language, Faith. After 5 years of grinding war with those Russian proxies in eastern Ukraine, a war that's killed 13,000 people, voters sent a signal that they were more concerned with internal menaces of corruption and poverty, ignoring Poroshenko's warning, delivered after he cast his own ballot on voting day, that voting for a comedian is not funny and could lead to painful consequences. Speaking at his campaign headquarters in Kiev, the Ukrainian capital, after the scale of this landslide victory became clear, Zelensky took a jab at Russia and other former Soviet lands that have turned elections into empty rituals. "As long as I am not officially president, I can say, as a citizen of Ukraine to all countries of the post-Soviet Union, look at us. Everything is possible." Poroshenko conceded that his presidency, that began in 2014 after street protests, ousted Ukraine's deeply corrupt pro-Russian president Viktor Yanukovych. He conceded his presidency was now over. Zelensky's triumph hits back at years of Russian propaganda presenting Ukraine as a failed state dominated by fascists steeped in anti-Semitism and contempt for Soviet fighters who defeated Hitler's forces in World War II. Though part of a trend that has brought the rise of maverick political outsiders to the top in both the U.S. and Europe, Zelensky shuns populist themes like hostility towards immigrants or minorities. Ukrainians worry less about outsiders coming in and more about many of their own people leaving to work in Europe, including even Poland and other wealthier countries, which is nearly everybody there. Ukraine has the lowest economic output per capita in all of Europe. He promises utopia, of course, but let it just be different, said voter Natalia Melnikova, who's 42. She added she didn't like either candidate on the ballot, but voted for the comedian. I want something to change, she said. Let the youth try. The prospect of a smooth transfer of power after a boisterous but mostly orderly election campaign shows how far Ukraine has moved from Russia, where listless elections offer no competition and for nearly 20 years have kept President Vladimir Putin in power. The beauty of this election is we didn't know when it started who was going to win, said David Kramer, a Russia expert, who was an assistant secretary of state under President George W. Bush. It's not a preordained exercise. Kramer is in the Ukraine with a team of election observers from the International Republican Institute, an independent observer group. Many voters supported Zelensky, not so much because they thought he was good, but because they wanted to punish Poroshenko for deflating all hopes raised by Ukraine's 2014 revolution and doing nothing to combat corruption. Poroshenko tried to rally support during the campaign, promoting himself as a defender of Ukraine's national interests against Putin, while Zelensky focused on what the incumbent's failure to deliver on promises to end crooked deals between officials and Ukraine's powerful oligarchs. Zelensky, who plays a teacher who improbably becomes president in the hit television series in Ukraine, Servant of the People, wound up his campaign lambasting Poroshenko at a raucous debate before more than 20,000 people in a Kiev stadium, referring to a 2017 pledge made by Poroshenko to tackle graft and cut off the hands of those who steal in the army. Zelensky asked, "Why do your people all have both their hands?" Speaking to supporters in Kiev, Zelensky said, "Thanks to all the Ukrainian citizens who voted for me and everyone who didn't. I promise I won't mess up." Hope he's right. In France, a conference featuring an address by Jewish philosopher Alain Finkielkraut was moved from a Paris university following threats of violent protest. The event on Europe's future was moved at the last moment to the IPAG Business School near Sciences Po University, the original location. It was held under heavy security. Protesters tried to block access to the event, but were held at bay by police. "Security is our top priority. It's preferable to take no risks," organizers of the event wrote. This event included other speakers, but they were not named in the letter threatening violent protests. Finkielkraut was accosted recently on a Paris street for being a Zionist. In their statement, authors of the call to demonstrate outside the event said, "We cannot accept Finkielkraut's modern Europe and his Islamophobic, racist, sexist, and homophobic rhetoric." A Sciences Po spokesperson called the group far left. The university recently canceled an event on Israeli apartheid, which the protesters alleged was showing a pro-Israel bias by the faculty. Lane Finkielkraut is a centrist thinker who has criticized the far right as well as Muslim communities and far left activists for failing to integrate into France. A best-selling author, Finkielkraut entered the Pantheon of French academia in 2016 when he became a member of the Académie Française, a council of 40 greats elected for life. A Zionist supporter of Israel, Finkielkraut is a member of the dovish J-Call group, styled after J Street in the U.S. In February, police had to extract Finkielkraut from a hostile crowd when he was recognized on the streets by participants of the so-called Yellow Vest demonstrations over the cost of living. His attackers called him a dirty Zionist and told him to go back to Tel Aviv. And tragically, last Sunday, there were awful Easter terrorist bombing attacks in Sri Lanka that struck churches and hotels there, massacring 321 people and wounding over 500. This was an unmitigated act of evil, supposedly a response to the horrible terrorist attack on the mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand a few weeks ago. In the midst of this awful religious carnage, there is a personal note. Two English teenagers, members of Westminster Synagogue in London, where my own congregation, Beit Simcha's Torah, came from, and where my great-uncle Harold Reinhardt was the founding rabbi, blessed memory, two teens from that synagogue died in these attacks. The bombs may have been aimed at Christians, but they killed indiscriminately. Daniel and Amelie Lindsay, her bat mitzvah took place earlier this year at Westminster Synagogue, were murdered in these atrocities. As surely as the other 319 people were murdered, it wasn't in the name of God, I assure you. In the last 6 months, that makes it three horrifying terrorist attacks on the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last fall, on the Christchurch mosques last month, and now at the churches and hotels in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday. This insanity must end. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Diane Shader-Smith. She's the mother of Mallory Smith, the late Mallory Smith, whose book, Salt in My Soul, An Unfinished Life, has just been published. Mallory died at the age of 25. The book is a record, really, of not her illness, but her vitality, although some of it is her experience of going through all of the medical processes, unfortunately necessary with cystic fibrosis. If you had to summarize the lessons, and there are so many that I'm sure people will take from this book, how would you summarize them? What do you think people should take from her life?
Well, the overarching theme is that despite horrific and overwhelming obstacles, you can make a decision to live happy. Now, that, of course, exempts people who have mental illness or depression, fear, and anxiety, which is called an invisible illness, which she does write about. But for many of us who allow ourselves to be bogged down by minor things that happen, I think the overarching theme is resilience and learning to live happy. But in terms of specific issues, she writes about invisible illness. She writes about disclosure and when to let people know you have a health condition. She writes about the opioid epidemic and the need for balance, which means in some cases, as we know, with this horrific number of kids who are dying from opioids, at the same time, they're undertreating patients who are in serious pain because of their fear. So there needs to be more balance, and she writes about that. She writes about the fact that sometimes when parents advocate for their children, it puts them at odds with the medical system, and how difficult it is for a child to know that the medical system, the doctors, some of the people that are providing care, aren't in agreement with the parents who might just be advocating to make sure that their child gets the best possible care. So she really touches upon, those are just a few, issues that most people can relate to. And in probably the most, in my opinion, important piece that she writes, it's about when our insurance company tried to deny Mallory coverage because the only hospital in the country that would do a transplant for Mallory was an out-of-state, out-of-network hospital, and she documents in great detail that battle.
You know, CF is such a insidious and difficult disease to fight because it comes and then it goes, and then there's periods of energy, and then, of course, the infections come in. She was a swimmer, water polo player, volleyball player, watched her diet like a hawk, changed her diet at various times. It's a really interesting story. As her mom, watching that and experiencing that, was it always easy to support her in her various changes?
All of them, except for two that I can recall. When she became a vegetarian, I thought I was going to have a heart attack. And it was all about animal rights and being kind to animals. And of course, she needed the calories and she needed the protein, and that was very difficult. So I did not support that choice. It's not that I don't support being a vegetarian or a vegan for other people, but in her case, it was not the right choice. And she came to that eventually, but not after a bunch of fights. The other time we had conflict, only one other time that I can remember, was when she was living in a beach apartment. We were all living in a beach apartment because it's so important to be in the salt air and in the salt water, which helps thin the mucus, which is a big problem for those with CF. And she was walking around in Santa Monica barefoot, and I was terrified that she was going to pick up some bacteria. And she said, "Mom, that's not how you get sick." And we used to battle over that. But other than that, every single friend choice she made, every boy she ever dated, every academic choice, every athletic choice, I was completely in support of, because honestly, Mallory was awe-inspiring.
She was a prom queen. It seems so funny reading the book because it doesn't seem like her at all. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's interesting. When she was alive, I would always, when I cited her accomplishments, I always included prom queen, and every single time she would roll her eyes and say, "Mom, nobody cares." But my particular feeling is that they don't elect mean girls to be prom queen. They don't want to vote for the girls that they think are mean. I think Mallory won because she was beautiful physically, but more important, I think she was beloved by so many, and everybody knew what she dealt with and saw that she was always smiling. And I think that smile radiated a secondary kind of beauty that everybody just fell in love with.
You must miss her terribly.
Oh my God, yeah.
What fills that space for you?
Talking about her, bringing Salt in My Soul and Unfinished Life to publication, sharing her story and her words with people so that those who knew her can relive her life just as I'm doing, but those who didn't know her will get to know her. And that's incredibly healing and comforting. The other thing that's amazing is the press has written about the book and reviewed it, and it's all unbelievably positive. People are saying it's a must read. A Yale medical student, Fulbright scholar, wrote to the dean of the Yale Medical School saying it should be a must read for every medical student. A father of an 18-year-old who's a television producer called me after he read it and said this should be a must read for every 18-year-old girl. And a mother's group invited me to speak and said this should be a must read for every mother. So it's resonating, and that is incredibly, incredibly healing.
In writing about Mallory, well, you didn't really, I keep thinking you wrote the book, though of course Mallory wrote it. You had to edit 2,500 pages of her journal. Is that about right?
Yeah.
How did you decide? Was it her instructions only, or was it, I mean, obviously there had to be some critical choices you made.
Oh yeah. So what happened was, first I read it and realized there was definitely a book in there. And then I pulled 400 pages and I called my sister, who's a great writer. Her name is Meryl. And she went back and forth with me, and we were very comfortable with the draft. And I was planning to self-publish it because traditional New York publishing cycle takes 18 to 24 months. And I wanted this book out for Mallory's one-year anniversary, which was last November. She died in November of 2017, and my goal was November of 2018. But what happened was, after we got it to the point where I thought it was great, I put the word out that I wanted to find a New York seasoned, accomplished editor to make sure that in our love for my daughter, that I had actually made the best decision, and that we had, it wasn't slanted or skewed or biased. And actually, when my sister and I were working on it, one of the things she said to me is, you need to put something about your mother-daughter fight, because otherwise people are going to think you whitewashed the story. And the most amazing thing about the journal and Mallory's foresight and incredible maturity is that she did not put her anger at me in the journal. And I think it's because she knew deep down that someday she would die, I would read it, and that it would kill me if she had documented our fights in detail. So what I did was I went through her emails, because I knew that she'd been mad at me. Of course, we had some, you know, big fights. And I found an email that she had written to her dad, which is my husband. And she said, "Dad, Mom is being so mean. She's too controlling. She's telling me what to do." And she wrote this whole letter, and she asked Mark what he thought of it. And I put that letter in the book because of my sister's point that it was important to share it. So it wasn't actually in the journal, but it was her writing, unedited. Anyway, when I took the whole thing to New York to meet with this amazing editor whose name is Claire Wachtel, we sat down. I brought two computers. One had the 2,500 pages on it, and one had the 300 or 350 pages, whatever it was at that point. And she had spent a week or two reading it and making notes. And she said to me, for example, a very specific example, "Did she ever go to the prom? I'd love to see something." So I went to the 2,500 pages. That's why when you asked me the question,
yeah.
I thought, oh, that's so funny. So then I went to the electronic journal in front of her, so she's sort of my witness. I put in the word prom, and then the whole three pages came up, and then I sent it to her, and she cut a chunk out and said, "Use this." So at that point, I would say, she also said, "I'd really like to hear from Jack," which is Mallory's boyfriend,
right,
who we call her real-life Prince Charming. And we pulled some of his writing that he had documented. And so she helped make sure that the arc was, you know, done properly. And then at that point, she said to me, and I quote, "You cannot self-publish this book. It is way too important. Please give me a week with Random House. I have a feeling they're going to want this book." And sure enough, she brought in Richard Abadi, who's an amazing agent. He took it to Random House. And it was a very, very quick process. And originally they wanted to do it for May as a mother-daughter journey. But what I said was, I'm planning a book tour, and every book stop that I do is going to be connected to somebody who loved Mallory. And she had a huge network of people who loved her. And a lot of them are in grad schools across the country, or medical school, or business school. Some of them are in jobs, but summer people take vacations, and it's not a good time to do talks. So I push them harder than I've ever pushed for anything to do March. And I promised them that I would work tirelessly to make sure the book saw the light of day, because as we all know, with so many TV and movie options and cell phones and other distractions, it's hard to get people to focus on one particular book. And so I have set about to take the book across the country, and have currently 72, I think, stops set up. So that's how it happened.
And I bet you'll set up more. You know, it's always difficult when somebody dies young not to focus on the loss, but to focus on the life. How do you encourage people to do that?
My mantra is, sometimes a heartbreaking ending can be the beginning of a triumph. And Mallory wrote a book, and she left us her wit, her wisdom, and her words. And I think that is the most important thing for everyone to focus on. As a mother, what keeps me from drowning in grief is knowing that every single day, other people are losing children. There's an opioid epidemic. There's a fire catastrophically affecting Northern California. There's a war zone in another foreign country. There are car accidents. I mean, if you actually are not, you know, only focusing on your own life, you do realize that every day people die. And the death of my daughter is one death. And it's tragic and horrific. And it will, you know, cause me great pain and leave a hole in my heart for the rest of my life. But I do recognize that she is gone. And so what I want to do now is honor her memory and share her story and her words, which I do think are already helping other people. I could give you 300 pages of testimonials from people who have written to say that the invisible illness really touched them and helped them, or the fight with insurance gave them some ideas for what to do, or they're going to look for a new approach to pain management. So people are really responding and reaching out, and that's incredibly cathartic.
In a Jewish sense, when we think about someone's life, it's the memories that bring them back. It's the stories that make them live again for us. If there was one story that you haven't told us yet that you could share about Mallory, what would it be?
Wow. Well, because she's so saintly like, and she really was, I'll tell you a funny story.
No, but you know, she may be saintly, but she comes across in the book as a real person with anger and emotions and curse words and everything. You know, it's not a whitewash.
Well, I was going to share one funny story that shows her spunk. After transplant, there was a very brief window of time where we thought she was going to make it. She had done incredibly well after transplant and surpassed everyone's expectations. But she did have a superbug, and the superbug had recolonized the new lungs, and that's why she didn't make it. But in that very, very brief window, Jack was visiting in Pittsburgh, and I was cooking, which I was always doing for them, well, for her, really. And Jack turns to me, and he says, now that Mallory has passed transplant and done so well, and it's time to think about moving back to California, because we had to relocate to Pittsburgh to get the transplant, he said, I would like to live with Mallory at the beach. Are you okay with that? And Mallory, who was kind of, you know, lounging, still in pain and recovering, leapt up and lurched at him, and in a very uncharacteristic way said, Jack, why are you asking her? You should be asking me if I want to live with you. And we always laugh, and Jack and I still laugh at that story, because Mallory's, the reason she was so beloved was she did not ever create drama. She did not walk into confrontation. She walked away from it. She used her journal when she was angry with someone to share those feelings. She didn't confront people. She didn't want her life to be defined by negativity. She knew it was short, and she wanted to make sure that the memories were happy and the moments were happy. And so I think that story is just hilarious, and we still laugh about her leaping off the couch, which was very uncharacteristic.
I want to thank Diane Shader Smith for a great visit. The book is called Salt in My Soul, An Unfinished Life by Mallory Smith. Where can people go to find out more about Mallory and about the book?
Well, so there's two things. One is the book, the website is saltinmysoulbook.com. So saltinmysoulbook.com. But I want to say, and it's very important to me that you share this, that we're donating 100% of the profits, because we do not want one penny to go into our pocket. We don't want people to think the reason we're pushing her story is for money. And Mallory received an experimental treatment at the end of her life called phage therapy, which is incredibly important, as it's one of the only
viable options for treating superbugs, and the World Health Organization writes that by the year 2050, 10 million people per year will be dying. So we're donating the bulk to that, but we are also donating to some of the children's hospitals that we're speaking at and some of the important organizations that we're working with along the way.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Dr. David Warmflash, author of The Moon, an Illustrated History, about the Jewish aspects of our closest heavenly body, the recent Space IL attempted lunar landing, and much else. Our playout this morning comes from 613. I know, Passover is finally over, and we are now in the period of the counting of the Omer, but I have to play 613's a cappella version of Pesach according to the Lion King, because, well, it's silly, but also ridiculously well done. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week of Chametz, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Ma nishtana halayla hazeh. Slaves, so we're Chametz free. I'm eating a matzah.
And who doesn't love some good matzah?
What's a matzah?
Nothing. What's a matzah with you?
We had to hurry from the land we were slaves.
Yes, so we're hummus free.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.